I was talking to Karen Locker the other day from Solutions for E-Commerce. We all know she's a sponsor of my show. She pays me. I don't want to hide that, right? The other thing she reminded me, though, is that if you sign up for her service through my link, you get $50 off, right? You knew that. I forgot that she offers an inventory health assessment. I'm like, Karen, I probably should be talking about that. That valuable service, she's going to take a look through your inventory and help you figure it out. They're going to take care of your suppressed listings. You're tired of having stranded inventory? Is inventory getting lost? When's the last time you looked at your shipments to get them reconciled? How about refunds? Has that happened? Well, Karen takes care of all that for me. She's been doing it for almost 2 years. I pay the same rate you do, but I'm very, very pleased with the service. And two guys, two well-known guys in the area, reach out to me saying, hey, you've been with her. Are you satisfied? I'm perfectly satisfied. And again, I can message her. I get the services I need. So it's Solutions for E-Commerce. The only way you're going to get that deal is using my code Momentum. I have a link on my website. You have to go there. If you're thinking about outsourcing that piece of your business, get your inventory looked at.
Welcome to the E-Commerce Momentum Podcast, where we focus on the people, the products, and the process of e-commerce selling today. Here's your host, Stephen Peterson.
Welcome back to the E-Commerce Momentum Podcast. This is episode 214, Brandon Checkitz. Now, most people won't know that name, or they won't connect it with Seller Labs, because they usually think of Seller Labs and Jeff Cohen, because he's everywhere, and that's intentional. He is everywhere, and he is the face of the company. But behind the scenes is the main owner of the company, Brandon Checkitz. Quite frankly, the coder. Very cool story, because when you think about a multi-million dollar business, I mean, they're a big business now, 60 employees they have. I mean, it's a big business. And yet when you hear where the idea came from, you'll be like, are you kidding me? It's kind of like when somebody invents something and they saw, you know, the toasters wasn't working right. So they came up with the better, you know, toaster or whatever. It's kind of interesting how he got into this business, where it really started from. Fascinating stuff. Let's get into the podcast. Welcome back to the E-Commerce Momentum Podcast, and I'm really excited about today's guest because I doubt that many people know him. They might have heard the name. They might have. They absolutely heard the company. They've heard the company a million times, and they would always associate it with Jeff Cohen because he's the visual face of the Seller Labs team. But there is a behind-the-scenes pretty cool guy who I got to meet personally and met him with his staff, which I love to talk about, because when I watched like guys with their kids to see what kind of dad they are, here I got to watch what kind of leader he was with his team, and I got to see it, and I always appreciate that. So Brandon Checkitz, welcome, Brandon.
Thanks. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
I really appreciate you coming on. I know you're busy, it's true. All those statements are true. I got to see you in your element with your team, and man, there's you got a following. That's pretty cool, isn't it? I mean, you really do have a following.
We've got a pretty good group here. I think you saw us at our trade show we put on, and so we had a pretty good number of our staff there that was all, you know, putting on the show, there to interact with other people, and I think they did a great job of that show. I was really proud of that. So
it was absolutely one of the stellar events I've been to. I'm a detail guy, that was one of the six conferences I've been to, and there was one other one that really had it really perfect. You guys paid attention to the littlest detail. You made it so easy. As I said to Jeff, you know, little things like, hey, here's where a break is, here's where the bathroom is, all the little things that I would have to ask. You guys answered all those things. I'm like, somebody really put a lot of thought. And then having each team member come up and talk about their product, and you could hear the passion in it, that also connected with me. And I felt really good about that. And I could see as a user that why people come to this conference and why I'll be at this conference now probably forever, because it's that strong of a conference.
I appreciate the feedback. That's great to hear. I'm glad that you had that experience while you're there. We did go through quite a bit of effort to make sure that everything comes out just right.
Well, it was apparent. So, all right. So you are the owner of Seller Labs, and you've got a whole bunch of other companies, right? I think Brandon Checkitz Inc. or something like that, right? So you started, were you a computer guy? Are you the computer side of the business?
Yeah, so I really started as a computer geek for the most part. So I've always been pretty interested in entrepreneurship. I started my first real, I guess you'd say I grew up in elementary school and stuff, selling candy to the other kids in school.
Oh, so you were that guy.
I was that guy.
You were that guy. Were your parents entrepreneurs?
No, not necessarily. My dad always wanted to be and had lots of ideas. The one thing we eventually did get going was a computer store. So when I turned 16 years old, we started the computer store with mostly my parents, obviously, and I was
really
kind of doing the computery stuff.
So wait, was he a geek too? Was he a wannabe?
Yeah, well, my dad's he's a computer networking guy. So
okay,
he's the guy that programs switches and routers and runs cables and all that kind of stuff.
And so you knew nothing but that, right? So you grew up in that environment.
Yeah, I grew up. I mean, we had a computer. This is I was born in 79, so we had a computer when I was six. I don't know how old I was, but we had an old IBM XT, 8Cs. And I remember going through and installing DOS and installing the old version of Windows from floppy disks onto the 20 meg hard drives and all that kind of stuff. So I kind of grew up with computers in my blood.
And your mom was into it too?
Yeah, my mom was in the computer store when we got that started. She was like the bookkeeper for the store, I guess.
And okay.
So,
okay.
And background in banking and stuff.
So even at dinner, this is what was talked about, business. I mean, it just, did the computer life flow right into your whole life?
Yeah, it was mostly, like I said, my dad was into computers from the very get-go, from as far back as I can remember. And then he always was an idea guy too, having lots of ideas for businesses to start and things like that. Never really went out to take the risk to do most of those until we got to the computer thing.
So was he? So he had a big idea, but he wasn't an executioner?
No, I mean, I think he was, I'd say he was probably, married with four kids and had to have a little bit of stability and predictability around that.
Okay, so. All right. So he was a security guy. Okay, well, that's good. That's really good.
Yep.
So you grew up in that environment. Yeah. Did you go to school for computers or what were you thinking?
So I graduated from Weber State University, which is in Utah, not very far from where I lived, with a degree in telecommunications administration, which is kind of computer related-ish. Actually, it was mostly the kind of stuff my dad did along the lines of programming routers and networking equipment and phone switches. So that's what my degree was actually in, but I've never really used it that much.
Were you going to just follow his path? I mean, work for one of the big giant telecom companies what was the vision then?
No, I think I'd always appreciated entrepreneurship, trying to do something on my own. I always liked working. In my history, I've worked for a couple of big businesses, but for the most part, I've always enjoyed working for really small businesses. And so I've always had this entrepreneurship, small business has been part of what I can, as far back as I can remember, that's what I wanted to do.
With the computer store that your parents have, did it succeed or did it fail?
You could call it a moderate success, I guess.
Okay.
So it paid some bills. Eventually we closed it down so that we'd go do other stuff, but, it was, this is probably in the mid-90s, I suppose. When computer parts were getting to be, there's no margin left in them. All this stuff was built into services and stuff like that. So
okay.
we shut down because I was actually leaving to go on a mission for my church. And so there was nobody left to run, really do the day to day at the store. So
you were the business at that point, right? It's the services, right? You had to be that guy and, they didn't want to go out and bring somebody else in. Is that where it was at?
Yeah. So I was the guy that was there most of the days doing most of the work as far as repairing and fixing and building computers. So. Without me there, there wasn't much left to do.
Okay, so you obviously had a taste for it. You went and did some work at some bigger companies. What didn't you like working for the bigger companies?
Well, the biggest company I ever worked for was Disney. So I
me too. I worked there too.
That's a fun place. I actually worked at Disney World when I was just about about a year from graduating from college. Did a college program there. The thing that frustrated me there was just one of the things was the budgets. They have these ideas of we have to spend so many hours this week because if we don't use our money and our budget, our hours this week, we're not going to get them for next year.
Ouch.
So this idea of like we had to spend money so that we're more comfortable next year. Like we essentially had to waste money in order to make sure that we have a little bit cushier life next year. That just rubbed me the wrong way as somebody who was always interested in efficiency and operations.
Well, because it's a cost, right? I mean, if they didn't spend that money there, they might have been able to do something that generated more revenue, right? And as that's probably where your mind would go, hey, there's something we could do with that money to make us money rather than just waste it and make sure we have it for next year, right?
Yeah, I mean, the situation I was in was really like people wanted to, like the park was slow. So I worked in the Magic Kingdom for a little bit and the Magic Kingdom parking lot and Tomorrowland merchandise stuff. And it would be like maybe a slow park day with plenty of employees and cast members there that wanted to go home, but they wouldn't let people leave because they wanted to make sure they used X number of hours today, so that when they were budgeting for the following year, they'd be able to like have plenty of money into their budget for next year.
It's government accounting. I mean, it's exactly the same way. Yeah, yeah.
That's the thing that really rubbed me wrong about big businesses like that. They've got these layers of stuff and budgets and. It's just like people, the department was not rewarded for actually reducing costs, but they were actually inflating costs so that they make sure how they have their budget for next year.
You know, thinking about that, you know, with layers, you know, looking at your company now, how far away is the I don't want to call them the lowest employee, the newest employee, the what's the furthest point from you, any one of the employees are? How many people away?
We've got about 60 people between all the stuff that I kind of oversee. I'm in the same office as most everybody. So we all see each other. We have lunch on Friday, kind of very intentionally to try and get everybody together. But some people get hired without me knowing who they are necessarily at this point. And so that's, you know, I see a new face sometimes. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I remember we decided to hire a new support person. So you must be...
Okay,
that is,
but more than, I mean, not more than one or two people away, right? Between
no,
you.
No.
Okay. And
no.
that's probably intentional, right? I mean, is that going back to that point, you know, that you never, because, you know, quite frankly, I mean, let's be personal, it's your money, right? So now you've got to sit there and think about those decisions because you've got to make, you know, tough choices. Do I spend money here or do I spend money here, right? I mean, sure, there's competing, every dollar is being competed for because you got so many things going on, right? And so does that come all the way back from then, you think?
I don't know. I think it's just, you know, you watch a show like Undercover Boss or some of those kind of things. Like, it's always good for the boss to sort of know what's going on all the way down the line. So
okay.
I think that kind of flows through. Like, it's, the people who are really interacting with the customers all day, those are the ones that really get a really good feel for what's going on in the day to day. So I think I trust those people and know and understand that they have the direct influence and the direct contact with some of our customers.
And if you don't pay attention to them, you think about what they're doing to your brand, right? I mean, quite frankly, that's really, really important.
Yeah, exactly. So they're, like I said, they're the face of the company for a lot of our customers. They're the people that if you call in, you talk to somebody there, and they're the face of the company for many people.
I appreciate that you recognize that. Tell me what were you thinking with starting a company? I mean, was this idea for you were in a book business, correct? How you got where you are today, if we go all the way back to where it started, would it be a book business? Am I correct when I understand that?
Yeah, so I actually still run and own a website called bookscouter.com, which is a price comparison website for selling textbooks. So where we're at today with Seller Labs evolved from where that was. So what was happening with Book Scouter was we had the website there. It was driving money, making pretty good money at the time. And then I figured, you know, I know as much about book pricing and book, all this stuff around textbooks and books that as much as anybody else. And some people are using my software, my website to go out and make money. So I might as well go out and use my own data and technology to make money as well.
Well, you started a technology company. Usually most people start those to solve a problem. They have a book business and they're using tools and the tools don't meet their needs adequately. So they like, heck with this. I'm going to go start my own, you know, or I'm just not really start a business. I'm going to get some software to solve my problem. You actually went the other way. Why books? I mean, what was attractive to you? You're a techie guy. You could have went into anywhere, especially telephone, right, or whatever. Why books?
I don't know. Books is just something I stumbled upon. My wife had a friend who was blogging about getting out of debt, and she was talking about selling her textbooks. And so
no kidding.
She blogged about how she had to go compare web prices at four or five different websites, and I figured, hey, I could do that. And so in a weekend or two, I whipped up the original version of the site, and it caught on and did well.
A weekend or two. Oh, you know, I just was bored for the weekend, so I just figured I'd pump up. You're not one of those guys who pounds down Mountain Dews and eats, nerd food and just flows through a weekend, can you?
I don't know if I'm not that stereotypical accurate.
Whew, man, I've seen some of those guys, and I'm always like, he's like, yeah, I got a big night of code ahead of me. I'm like, oh my God, you're scaring me. Yeah.
I'm more of a practical, like I like to solve business things or things that are meaningful. I don't necessarily care about the technology for the sake of the technology. I want to see the technology. What can it do for me?
It's interesting me, though, that this big idea, I mean, think about this. Look where you are now. How many millions of dollars in sales? And it came from you reading your wife's friend's blog about getting out of debt. That's where the big idea. It wasn't like, the clouds opening up, the beams of light coming down. No, it was you reading a blog and saying, huh, something there was interesting to me. I mean, think about that. I mean, it's gotta draw something out of you to say, I can't believe where we're at from something that I read. And I guess I would call you a noticer then, like myself. You noticed something and there was for some reason you were attracted to it, and look where it's taken you. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately it comes down to like, this is something that I think should exist. And if I don't build it, somebody's going to. So it might as well be me.
Okay, so you decide to build it. You spend a couple weekends, which is ridiculous, by the way. I'm just going to tell you that. You spend a couple weekends and you come up with a product. I mean, it's so far-fetched. I can't even think for a weekend to even think about having a product. You whip one out. And what did you do with it?
So I guess just initially I mentioned it to her, and she was part of a blog network that when she mentioned it on her blog, it went out to dozens of other blogs, and before long I got a few people visiting my website, and I think I had my first sale, within a week or two.
And so the premise was what? What would it do? It would scan a textbook and go out to Amazon, or what were half.com, or what was it you doing?
Yeah, so the user would put in one of the ISBN barcodes from their book, and it would go out to, I think originally it was four or seven different websites, and grab all the prices from those four or seven websites and display a summary on the screen and say, if you want to sell your book for the best price, you go to this website because it's offering this price on it. You can see all the data together in one view.
And so their premise was they would do the math in their head and say, as long as I pay less than $5, I can sell it for $25 or something like that, right?
Well, these were people that were just trying to sell books around their house. So they're books they had already owned. So the first lady, I kind of developed it with her in mind she just graduated from with a doctorate degree in something where she had a lot of books that were very expensive. I'll say it that way.
And so she was just going to sell them herself. So you were just, hey, this is again, thinking that you were going to get people out of debt. Was that really, I mean, that seem to connect with you? I mean, you mentioned you're on a mission trip, so you have some kind of faith that you're following. Is that connected to you?
Yeah, I mean, I always like the concept of helping people. So that's always been very interesting to me as well. And in a lot of things I guess I've done, there's always a human component to it. And it's always been, people are using our software now to make money. So for them and their family and for their employees, like, there's always kind of a people component that kind of does flow back to that.
I love it. Love it. Okay. So you, you'd sell it to this lady. You get one or somebody in their group sells and you're like, proof of concept, one sale, or maybe I got to do something else.
Yeah. Well, I guess the first proof that was, this is not my first time making money online either. So I've done other things before that. And it's always kind of exhilarating to get that first sale. And then the second sale, and you sort of see, like, actually people are using this.
Well, did everything that you did online make money?
I'm sure I've done stuff that hasn't been very successful, but I'm sure I've wasted plenty of time doing stuff that meant nothing. But, before I even got into this, years before, I used to sell, like, virtual currency on eBay and stuff like that.
Oh, my God.
I made my own website for selling virtual currency.
I don't even know what virtual currency is.
Are you familiar with a game like World of Warcraft or?
I've seen nerds play that. Yeah.
Yeah. Think of it as in the game you earn money, you earn gold, specifically in World of Warcraft. And instead of going through the process of earning money or spending time playing the game to earn gold, you can just go to one of these companies and you'll pay $20 to buy, 500 or 1,000 gold or something.
Oh, that's cool.
So it was way back before World of Warcraft. I ran a thing where we'd buy currency in a Star Wars game and would buy and resell that. So
I appreciate nerds when I talk about that, because I'm envious, because I just don't have that capacity. So you sell how many before you realize that this could be a viable? I mean, is there a number when, I guess I'm even going forward to today, when you look at it, how do you identify a market? I mean, was five sales enough of a market for you? Is that like, okay, this is all, I'm going all in? Or was it 100 sales? I mean, what was it back then?
Well, this was very part-time, so it was very easy just to say, yeah, I made $4. So that was a nice extra $4 or something. So I was able to work, and I was doing freelance consulting and stuff at the time and doing software development on a per-project basis for others. So this was just my own little project on the side that started to make some money. So it wasn't like I wasn't going full force into it for quite a while.
You didn't see that it would be doing millions of dollars in business. I mean, at what point did you see it?
Well, I started Book Scouter clear back in 2007 sometime, and then shortly after I launched that, you might appreciate this story a little bit, I got a call from this guy named Jeff Cohen, who worked at another website that was selling a price comparison website similar to mine, but it was on the side of buying textbooks. So it was comparing prices for students who needed to buy their textbooks for their semester. And so I actually got a call from Jeff, or an email from Jeff or something along the lines. And then he was looking for a programmer to help him, develop this Campus Books website that he was working on. So I actually worked for Jeff for a number of years.
Oh, that's funny. He probably never lets you forget that, does he?
We have a very good working relationship.
He's an amazing guy. I just love, I could see him though, Brandon used to work for me. I mean, technically, I could see Jeff doing that. So you did some work for him. And when you looked at that side of the business, I mean, had you thought about that side of the business, because you're on the other side of the development? Now you see the other side.
Yeah, I was new to textbooks. Jeff had a long history inside in the book and textbook industry, and so he was very familiar with all that. I was just a guy who made this little website for a couple people. He happened to pick up on it because it was in the same space as he was, and it was kind of interesting to him that he was just at the right time where he was needing to find a programmer. So it was a good deal for him.
Did it help you, like, see the vision of where Book Scouter would go at some point? I mean, when you saw both sides of it now, because you saw one side, the selling side, now you're seeing the buying side. I mean, is that when the clouds kind of opened and you saw the potential?
Definitely when I was on that side of it, that side of the business was much, much bigger than the buyback side of the business.
Right,
so
right.
That was where everybody was dumping their money at, was trying to figure out how to sell their books. So there was a pretty big industry around, college textbooks, and this was all just starting to come online. This was kind of like the early days. This is like 2007 timeframe, so Amazon's not new, but they're kind of the dominant force in textbooks by this time.
Right. The other one would have been Half.com. I mean, you still had the Follett's and all those kind of, but Half.com, which, by the way, announced they were closing last week, right? Just coincidentally on this call. So at that point, you're still doing consulting work. You just did some consulting for that side of the business. At what point did Book Scouter become a business where you needed a partner?
Well, I guess Book Scouter, by the time Book Scouter was making more money than I was making at my full-time job at Campus Books for working for Jeff was when I decided this is kind of a big deal. So I was, working as a programmer on that side of the business, but Book Scouter had grown to the point where it was making more money than my full-time job.
And Book Scouter was still your side business, Campus Books or whatever it was called, that what you were doing programming for them on the other side. And you say, hey, this is now going to be a viable business.
Yeah, it's like, well, I'm gonna quit my full time job so I can pursue the side business for full time.
Now, you said you have some entrepreneurial spirit in you, selling, gum and baseball cards to other kids and stuff. Are you a businessman, or were you a businessman then? Let me ask it that way.
I don't know. The businessman has its connotations around it. I don't think I fit into most of those stereotypes, but I would say I guess I am a businessman.
You're a businessman. Were you a businessman then? I mean, obviously you've grown into one, but were you then?
No, I was mostly a hacker, programmer.
Okay, so you were a programmer. So you brought on a partner. And was that partner to fill in the gap that you didn't have?
Yeah, so essentially, I was doing book. This is after I've been doing Bookscatter for a little while, and saw the opportunity to sell physical books because I think I knew quite a bit about books and I have my own software and pricing information. So I was talking with a friend one day and said, you know, I wish I could find some places to buy books in bulk where we could just start using our technology and figure out how to make money at this. And that's where our partnership with Paul kind of started out from.
And Paul's last name is?
Paul Johnson.
Paul Johnson. So Paul Johnson, yep. Became a full partner with you or partial partner? I mean, you don't got to get into the technical stuff, but I mean,
We actually started doing our own sort of separate businesses, and I was sort of a partner in his, and he was a partner in mine, all kinds of like kind of confusing stuff. But we were both running sort of parallel businesses where we would actually go to the USPS auction, which is in Atlanta, not too far from where we live. And so all the stuff that the USPS loses during the course of a month goes up for auction. And they used to sell it at an in-person auction at the Mail Recovery Center in Atlanta. So wait, like the
luggage wars I've seen on TV, basically the same concept?
Yeah, same concept, except this would be the stuff that was shipped and lost. So.
And many books get shipped and lost?
Oh, my goodness, you wouldn't believe how many books get lost in the
you got to give us the vision. So you go to this auction. I mean, is it a pallet? Is it two pallets?
Yeah, are you familiar with the Gaylord? It's like a,
four by four box,
right?
Yep, four by four.
So they'd have about, on any given month, there'd probably be, on the low side, there'd be 20-ish Gaylords full of books. And then on a peak month, like after Christmas season or after textbook season, they'd have, the most I ever saw at once was three tractor trailers, and each one of those tractor trailers had about 26 pallets on it. And then another 60 or something pallets up for auction individually.
Oh my God. And you would bid on per pallet?
Yeah, they had different ways of doing it, but mostly by pallets. And in some cases, when they had a whole truckload, I mean, you just say, I want that whole truckload for X number of dollars.
And I think contextually, let's just be sure, right? Those books were sold and just never delivered or bought for somebody as a gift or whatever. So there's probably value there, right? I mean, common sense would tell me there's value.
Yeah, I mean, that's where it's actually kind of surprising. And I don't know what they go for nowadays, but when we were buying, it was about $3,000 for a Gaylord full of books. And it went up to around $5,000 by the time we kind of stopped doing that.
One Gaylord.
So pretty expensive. Yeah.
Wow.
And that's the premise, though. It's like all these books have been bought and shipped recently, so there's probably something of value to them.
And so somebody right now is listening saying, oh, my God, they just outed my source. I'm sorry. I've never heard of it before.
Plenty of people that know about it, so it's not a
Well, this is the first time Steve's ever heard about it, and I consider myself pretty well-rounded. But it makes sense, right? I guess it makes perfect sense that you know, all government auctions. I mean, I'm familiar with many government auctions, but the post office has their own, of course. So you were buying pallets and spending $3,000. What kind of return would you get on a pallet like that?
Well, on our very first ones, we'd almost double our money on them. So we'd buy them for $3,000 and make $5,500, I think, was kind of some of our initial math. So we'd almost double our money on some of that.
And he brought that model to you?
Well, I think we kind of co-developed this. So I actually did the book thing, and Paul did a similar thing with sort of like electronic items and sporting goods. He did more of a liquidation on like anything he could find, he could buy. And I was more specific around books and media stuff.
Okay, but still using either Amazon, eBay, or any of those other channels at that time.
Yeah, most of the books would go on Amazon. Most of Paul's stuff on his business would go on, probably 80% of it would go on eBay.
Okay. And was your software helping his business too? At that point?
Yeah, so this is where we started to get into the software side of it. So I got to the point where this was early on in the days of FBA, and the initial things we would actually send on the book side, we developed a software thing that was around the Bookscatter website. And so I would scan a barcode on a book, and it would look up all the prices on Bookscatter, look up all the prices on Amazon, and it would say, you know, do you want to sell this to one of the vendors on Bookscatter and get like an immediate check for it? Or we could send it over to FBA, and we'd have all the pricing pulled in, and we could estimate all the fees, and we'd know exactly what we'd made after it sold. And so the very initial software we wrote was scan a book, and then it would say to either push it over to Amazon and send it to FBA, or it would say push it over to our own one of our buyback companies through BookScatter.
Like Follett Books or one of those companies that were buying books back then, right?
Yeah, like textbooks.com and BookBite and all these different sites that were
so it was truly optimized in that scenario, right? You got the most value, right?
Yep.
And then you just had to deal with hassle, right? You know, shipping it FBA still had a little bit more of a hassle at that point, right? Because it's not final until it sells. But if there was a financial number, then you could say, hey, it's financially worth it. Boom, the risk is there. Boom. Oh, man, that's optimized. Yeah. And so you did that kind of selfishly for yourself and him. I love it, which I appreciate, by the way. That's a true entrepreneur. That is an entrepreneur. You are there. And so you did that. And the results were positive, I take it.
The results were good and well. So I was doing the book stuff. Paul was doing liquidations with other stuff and doing his own sort of software with some of that. We decided to go for it. So I operated out initially. The very first pallet was out of my garage. We decided to go at a little bit bigger scale, and I rented some storage units. So I think I had, you know, some of these 10x10, 10x30 storage units. We'd go over there, and that's where we sort of hired our first employees. And then scaled past that over to a 4,000-square-foot warehouse, and then eventually to a 15,000-square-foot warehouse. So it grew up pretty quickly over the course of probably about 2 years. We scaled up from doing nothing to having a big warehouse.
So you could connect really well with your customers who are going through the same thing, because let's face it, that's where everybody usually starts, in their garage. So you've walked the walk, not just talked the talk. I didn't know that, that you've done all that. So when you're talking about it, you could say, I've lived and breathed it, Steve. I've done it.
Yeah, that's what makes it, I guess, really interesting for me to develop software, is because I've done this multiple times. So we know pretty well how people use it and what they're trying to accomplish.
Which part of the business did you love more? The handling the physical products and the team and all that kind of jazz, or the software development and maybe even coding? I don't know what, you know, whether you're still doing your own coding or if you've outsourced that at that point.
Well, I tell you, there's something that's really satisfying about writing code and then actually having it like mean something in the real world. So we were actually writing software where we'd scan a barcode, we'd print off a sticker. The sticker would go to a shelf, it'd help us find our inventory. And then to be able to, like, when somebody bought something, we'd be able to say, hey, the book is located over on shelf 5 green over there. And, like, actually writing software to do something in the real world was, like, really gratifying.
So that really connect with. And so, and hence the reason we look forward to today, where you've got how many pieces of software. Okay, so things are chugging along, and BookScouter still selling. Had you offered all these other, you know, you developed this stuff for yourself. Had you offered that to your existing customers, or was that still just kept close to the vest at that point?
Yeah, so I was still doing BookScouter at the time, and then we were writing this inventory management side of the business to help us manage our online sales on Amazon and eBay. But we ended up going to trade shows, mainly for BookScouter, because we wanted to go and promote BookScouter, because that was an established thing. But we'd go to these trade shows and we'd see some of the Amazon software out there, some of the other tools that were out there, and we thought, like, our software is actually better and provides features that these other things don't have. And that's when we kind of made the decision to switch from, like, doing this physical liquidation type of model over into the software side. Because we figured the inventory system that we had built and some of the stuff that we built on our technology just for our own business had more features and was better than what was being sold at these trade shows we went to. So,
did you also realize that, quite frankly, that you were the limit of, you know, the physical product scale? Is there's always a limit, right? It's people and, you know, number of units they can touch. Software, there really is no limit, right? The number of customers could be infinite. You know, I mean, it just depends on demand, right? I mean, did you have that vision, or was that Paul's vision?
That was something I think we realized after we'd been doing software for a little bit, but it became very evident. You know, if you have say $200,000 worth of books, like, you can expect to sell X number of thousands of dollars of books and have a profit of some percentage of that. Which is going to be smaller than your investment. Or on the software side, it's completely the opposite. You can spend X number of dollars developing software and you can sell it millions of times. So it became a very easy decision when we decided to shut down our warehouse and sell it off to somebody else.
It's like a vending machine, right? That's really what you've created.
Yeah.
And it just kicks it out. Yeah.
Yeah. We put a lot more effort, and there's a bigger risk, I guess, going into the software side, because you end up spending a lot of money to develop a piece of software. But once you've found people using it, once you know that it provides value, like, it's sellable multiple times with very, very little incremental cost. So,
was it easy? I mean, looking back, right, you know, then when things are rocking. So just as you get ready to sell your business off the physical side of the business, was it easy for you, the business side?
The business side of the physical
Stuff? Yeah, I mean, just at that point, I mean, it sounds like you were flowing, right? Like you said, when I write a piece of code, I get the reward. I feel good about myself because I get to see somebody use it. I mean, that's a, you know, almost like an instant gratification kind of thing. Was that easy? I mean, did it just flow up until that point?
I mean, coming up with the ideas for the software was always fairly straightforward because we were just using it to solve needs for what we had, what we could easily identify. And so coming up with the stuff was pretty, you know, we didn't have to think a lot because we knew exactly where we needed to spend our time and what we had that was the highest value. So it was pretty fairly easy to do that. I've been very fortunate to be, you know, find some people that were really good at that complemented some of my weaknesses as far as like trying to manage people and find and hire other people to do like the tasks that I don't know how to do. So I think I've been very fortunate that we've been able to, you know, find the right people to surround myself with.
Well, what's hard then? What was hard for you?
What's hard?
Or what was hard then?
The people thing's always been kind of hard for me as far as like trying to find and hire people. I don't think I've ever figured out how to do that really well myself. And to train and to have, you know, just that all the stuff that it takes to hire and train somebody and make sure they have all the tools and resources they need to do their job. I guess I approach this more from a computer. It's like I gave you all the instructions, now just go do it.
Right, right. I'm just thinking how your mind goes. Like that's probably the hard part, right? Because your mind says, boom, write this, do this, go in this order, you will do this, right? But people have this little thing like a life and a spouse or a dog or whatever, and that messes it up, right?
It gets in the way.
So, yeah, it does get in the way.
Computers just do exactly what you tell them. And even when they're a bug, when you dig into it, you figure out, you know, it was just doing exactly what I told it. I just told it to do the wrong thing.
Oh, that's funny. I can see that.
But people are a little bit different. So some people get it really quickly. Some people don't get it at all, no matter how much you teach them. So,
as a guy, that's hard to admit that you know, I mean, let's face it. You're supposed to be the leader. You're supposed to be good at everything, right? Not necessarily.
No, I think there's lots of different kinds of people with different kinds of skill sets out there. So I think one of the keys to running an organization successfully is recognizing your own strengths and the strengths of other people and figuring out where to make everybody do, where to make everybody put their efforts so that you have the best overall outcome.
So I want to take a break because I want to get to Seller Labs. When you sold the physical business, how soon after was Seller Labs created?
Well, it was actually kind of working simultaneously for a while. We actually had a lease. We had to wait for it to run out. And so,
okay.
The physical bookstore just kind of fizzled for like a year or something until that lease ran out.
Okay. All right. And
then, so we're kind of mentally checked out of it for a while. And then eventually, once the lease was out of the way, then we sold it to somebody else.
And how long ago was that?
Boy, that was probably about 4 years ago now, I guess.
Okay. So 4 years ago. Okay. Wow. Yeah. So this really has evolved. All right. Let's take a break. I want to start where your first product for Seller Labs or how, you know, where Seller Labs kind of came from, what you thought it was going to be versus what it is today, because I'm interested in that. Be right back. Man, can you imagine just whipping out a weekend of code and, oh, it just happened to come up with the project. Jesus. God, these guys are smart. Okay, so I'm going to deal with a delicate, not my best interviewing skills used moment of dealing with something real personal for Brandon. I'm definitely more emotional about it. And just trying to be careful because I want to be respectful. And so we dance. He's very polite and gives the most direct answers. And I think that it's so useful, though, when life happens to you, as it happened to Brandon, and yet his business, because, and he's very quick to recognize that he's hired some great people and put the right people in place that have allowed him to get through these things. So he's very quick to recognize that. But it's really great. And then we also deal with a partnership that gets dissolved, but in the right way. Man, I love it. Love, love, love this story. Let's get back into the podcast. All right, we're back and we're talking with Brandon Checkitz, and we're talking, I love the story. I mean, the foundation of your business. And I can see all these little things kind of leading and building you towards someone. It really is a foundation when you think about it, Brandon, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think who we are as people is sort of a combination of all of our experiences we've gone through. So that's a very fair way of saying it. all these experiences that we've gone through kind of builds up to who we are.
And the negatives of the companies you work for, those are the things that you're not bringing into your company, right? I mean, there are some absolutes that you're just not going to, like that budget nonsense, right? You're not just saying, hey, you know, it's a zero-based budget every year, right? And that's really what it should be, right? Where the market is where you should spend your money, not necessarily just because, well, we did it last year, we should keep doing it. I think that's another hard thing for people to do, right, is to turn stuff off and to walk away. Did you feel like you lost something when you shut the bookstore or like you said, you'd already checked out?
Yeah, I mean, by the time before we were mentally checked out of it, we kind of felt bad, like this didn't really seem like it was successful. Like it, you could call it a success on some factor, but on some other you know, methods of measuring, it was kind of a failure as well. So ultimately, though, you know, you just saw a much better opportunity with the software side of things. So,
The market was changing. I mean, let's face it, look at where the market is today. Would that model be sustainable today?
Yeah, people still make money at books, but, you know, it's not easy. You have to constantly adapt and change. So.
Right. And so, yeah, I think you took the better course. Okay, so Seller Labs starts thinking what? What was the vision when you started it? What were you thinking?
Yeah, the vision when we started was to build this amazing inventory management solution that we started to build up with our warehouse. So,
because that was a pain point for you, right? That was what you're trying to do. That was a pain point.
Exactly.
Okay, you saw a weakness. Nobody else doing it. I'm going to do it better. Okay.
We've grown to the point where we had something like 100,000 books in stock, and when somebody bought one, you had to go find it. And so we built quite a bit of technology around locating and shelving things and all that kind of stuff. But again, syncing with Amazon, we actually built connectors with all the special postal stuff and shipping carrier. Like it was, you know, we had quite a bit there. So the initial version when we decided to go full time at Seller Labs was to build out our inventory management software.
And it was only going to be for books, or did you envision that it could be used for virtually any commodity?
Well, Paul was running his liquidation business out of as well. So we kind of targeted it towards people who were sort of in this liquidation business. So whether that was books or other sorts of physical products, we kind of envisioned it working for Amazon and eBay in any kind of liquidation type of stuff.
Okay, and so things are rocking, and what happens?
So we got to the point where I guess I'll interject one thing in there too. So one weekend, Paul went on a break. He took a trip to the beach, and another one of these weekend projects, I whipped out this little quick thing I called Feedback Genius that was essentially an email automation thing for Amazon.
So again, that's just a weekend project. Dude, are you sure you weren't pounding down Mountain Dews? I envision you drinking some kind of energy drink to be able to sit there and pound that junk out.
I'm a water guy. I drink lots of water.
Oh my God. You must not go to the bathroom, and then that makes you just write code faster. So you're writing code for a weekend. You just have this epiphany. Was it, again, trying to solve a problem that you had?
Yeah, again, this goes back to the story we've already told with buying stuff at the auction. USPS uses a whole lot of – they lose a whole lot of discs, like DVDs and CDs in the mail as well. Think of it as like the Netflix discs, where it's just the disc, there's no case to it, there's no artwork with it, it's just a plastic disc. And we were selling quite a few of these. We could buy them for a pretty good price at the auction. We'd buy like a 80-pound thing of them for $300 or something.
And how many are in 80 pounds? Sounds like a lot.
Yeah, it'd be like a couple thousand discs in there.
Oh my God.
So you can identify and go through those. There's some good money in it. But what we found is like when we go and sell them on Amazon, we put them in acceptable condition and we'd replace it and we'd ship it with a generic case and no artwork. And our descriptions there would say that, but people would still buy it anyway, not knowing that. And so our biggest complaint that we got on our book account was that people would buy this media and they'd complain that it didn't contain the artwork and it didn't contain the original case.
Did they think it was fake or something, or what did they think?
No, it wasn't even fake, but it's just most people, when they bought a disc or a DVD, they had expected to come in the movie case with the chapters listed out, or they bought a CD, they expected to have like the lyrics in it and all that kind of stuff. So they'd buy this, it would be just the disc. Again, we put it in a generic case, but we wouldn't have the artwork with it. And so that was our number one complaint, is people would buy these things. We'd make decent money on them, but frequently would complain that the product was missing the stuff, even though we noted it in the description. So the weekend project I did was essentially write up a system that would pull in all of our orders from Amazon, and it would identify all these things that we bought, because we were able to identify them with a SKU. And it would send the customer an email as soon as we noticed their order saying, you know, we just want to make sure that you notice that in our description where it says it doesn't include artwork and doesn't include a case. If you're not expecting that, please cancel the order now before we ship it to you, and so that you're not disappointed.
Okay, so you were trying to solve a pain point. If somebody is hung up on that, boom, tell them up front. How effective was it?
So we noticed our negative feedbacks dropped immediately. Obviously, it worked.
Well, could you tell how many orders got canceled? I mean, so somebody was, like you said, somebody was placing an order or placed the order, and you said, hey, yep. Steve, before you pay for it or whatever it is, I just want you to be sure this is what you're getting if you're clear. So were you able to track how many people backed out of the orders?
I don't recall remembering that cancellations went up significantly. I do recall that our negative feedback went down significantly. So
did your sales go down too? I mean, logically, you would think they would.
You know, we probably got some cancellations in there, but when we were shipping, you know, 50 to 100 of these a day or something.
Okay, so maybe you dropped to 97, right?
Yeah, if we had three or five people cancel, it wasn't a noticeable difference for us.
But they were the three or five that were probably pretty vocal, is what you're saying.
Hmm. Yeah, and they would have got a lot of negative feedback anyway. So
you're preventing a negative experience. I mean, so from an Amazon terms, that sounds like a good thing, right? You're preventing a negative experience. I like that. Okay. So the weekend project seems to be a success.
So the weekend project seems a success. Then the next thing that comes back is, how do we win the buy box more, right? Because we're competing with all these other people that are trying to sell these books and these DVDs. How do we win the buy box more? Well, one of the main metrics that goes into the buy box calculation was the seller feedback score. And our feedback score was, 96% or something like that. It wasn't 100%. So the next question was, how do we get more feedback? Because, you know, we obviously ship a lot of things and people are perfectly satisfied, but we're just not getting the feedback for it. It's not like eBay, where it used to be like 80% of people on eBay would leave feedback. And on Amazon, it's like 1% of people would leave feedback.
Right.
There's a big difference there. So,
well, let me ask you this, because it sounds like you figured out, hey, if we send an initial contact, we get rid of the potential negatives, right? Because that seems to be, was your thinking, hey, if we send a follow-up, we have the same effect for the positives, right? Is that what you were thinking?
Yeah, that's the hope. Is like, we know that normally, you know, 1% of people without any prompting or anything will leave feedback. If we can double that, we can get twice as much feedback, twice as fast, then our positive feedback rating will go up and we'll win the buy box more. And we'll sell more stuff.
Sounds logical. Was this another weekend project?
Well, by this point, I think we had some fundamental stuff there with all the emailing and pulling in orders and all that kind of stuff. So I don't know if it was a weekend project or not, but the next iteration of that was sending emails. We actually did something kind of fancy there, as we had the tracking numbers from all the products that we shipped. And so we actually cross-referenced the traffic tracking numbers with when they actually arrived, and then we'd email somebody, you know, the day after their product was delivered.
Oh.
Which was kind of revolutionary rather than the other tools that were out there at the time. And I still think there's not really any other tools that do this.
Were you writing the code yourself?
Yeah, I was writing all the code for this.
Are you kidding? I mean, you didn't. So the team was growing, but it wasn't in the code department. It was you.
So we started with a couple of programmers who started to figure out how to write code, but I figured by that point I was realizing that I was not a very good programmer, so by most traditional measures.
Well, because you were writing it the way, well, I mean, I guess I don't even want to begin to, cause I took a little bit of coding and I know that there are some people that just speak that language, right? And that's just the way they can even talk in that weird language, right? That's not you?
Yeah, so I never took a formal computer science class on how to write code. I never studied programming. I came from a background of hacking stuff together with PHP.
So it wasn't pretty, right? Your code wasn't pretty like these.
I thought it was beautiful.
In your world it was. Let's face it. If you can, let's just give due to a weekend project and it's a viable product. I'd say that's pretty in the entrepreneurial mind.
So, well, I thought it was beautiful, but nobody else could follow it, which is when I decided, well, I don't really know what I'm doing with this programming stuff. So,
and ultimately, that's where you get yourself into trouble, right? Because when things change, which they always do, going back and trying to fix, you know, if it's not consistent, right? That's one of the big things, right?
Yep. Trying to bring on other people to help you either fix bugs or scale out something new. Now you have to have two people communicate about the same code. And it's about 10 times more complicated, even though it's a second person. So,
okay. How long ago was that?
Oh, that was going back about 2011-ish. So
okay, so 2011. Okay, so Feedback Genius comes out, and you realize, hey, this sounds like, again, something I can sell. I mean, you were solving your own problem, which is very cool. When did you get that first customer?
So I actually emailed a bunch of my users on BookScatter and said, hey, we've got this new Feedback Genius thing over here. If you're interested in signing up for it, we'll let you have it for free for 6 months or something. And so we got some, I think we probably emailed 100 people or something and had 5 or 10 of them or something sign up.
Okay.
And give it a try. Got lots of bad feedback about how it didn't work and didn't work for the situation. And that's kind of to be expected with your first release of a product, is like, it works kind of for me, but when somebody else is using it in a different way and they couldn't do this and couldn't do that. But we got some initial traction with that. But it's kind of interesting. Throughout this whole time, our main focus from the business was to keep building our inventory management software,
which doesn't exist, correct?
Yeah, you'll know we don't have inventory.
Right, right. But I mean, but that's what's so cool, is that as you're going, you're solving other problems, and then you're recognizing, who recognized that Feedback Genius was going to be a business? I mean, who was the one who said, "Huh, there's money here," kind of like going back to the BookScatter model. Who was it? Was it you? Was it Paul? Was it Jeff?
I don't know. It was me or Paul, probably.
Okay.
I don't know when that happened exactly, but we kept going on this route of building out our inventory management stuff and going to trade shows trying to sell it. And what we found is, like, we got a lot of positive feedback. People said, "Wow, this is beautiful. It did FBA natively, and none of the existing tools really knew what FBA was, and if they did, it was not a very good experience trying to create FBA shipments." And our stuff did FBA natively. And so people loved it and thought it was great until they went to actually go use it. And then they're like, "Well, I kind of want to do this too. And I want to do this in a different way."
Oh, God. Oh, yeah.
If it could only do this, then I'd use it. And what we found is, like, we were trying to replace a tool that people use, like, all day, every day. And so they had very specific needs about how they wanted to work, and it had to be very bug-free.
Well, and everybody would do it their own way, right? And so they wanted it their way. And so you were trying to basically write FBA. I mean, that's what Amazon does, right? And so, I mean, it definitely was the wrong path to go down, right? However,
this is in the days of, like, FBA Power. I don't know if you remember that, or Scam Power.
Right, right.
The modern name of it. That was the big competitor kind of at the time. We thought, we're doing this a little bit better than them. How can we, start selling it? And then people started to use it, and they were like, "Well, I really," they weren't using it for the liquidation model, which is how we kind of designed it. And they had to create replenishments. And so they wanted to create different cost points and replenish their inventory. And so we actually went back to the drawing board and, like, re-architected the whole thing.
Oh, my God.
And spent another year trying to work on this new method, this new sort of design for it.
In that year, did anything kind of kick out any of the, I mean, because you have a whole bunch of other programs now that you run. Did any of them come in that year in the early stages that ended up being, like, the, preliminary scope or for Castle or any of those? Did any of them come in there?
Yeah, we had a really, really early version of Scope at the time.
Okay.
It was quite a bit different than it is today, but it was essentially a version where you could upload a bulk list of a bunch of products. And then we'd go back onto the Amazon and pull out all the pricing and all the fees and all that kind of stuff, and just summarize all that stuff for a big bulk amount of stuff at a time.
It sounds like your inventory system is a lab. I mean, it sounds like a place where you've created this big giant machine, and then it would run, and then you'd kick out a problem. Okay, let me go solve that problem. Hey, there's a business model here. I mean, that's what it keeps reminding me of, that, it was a, I guess you would say it's a failure because you put a whole bunch of time and effort into it and that never materialized, but it kicked off all these ancillary things that, quite frankly, are the things that are now viable, right? I mean, to me, that's kind of like a lab.
We realized the name's fairly intentional with that, but we did realize, like, we're not doing this well, but people are really liking this.
Hmm.
And I mentioned a year into development of this new inventory management thing, we still weren't getting traction on it, but Feedback Genius had gone from, zero customers to 20 customers to 100 customers to the point where we're working people signing up every day. We don't even know where they're coming from. And so that's when we kind of realized, there's something to this Feedback Genius thing and this inventory management stuff. I don't know if we're ever going to get it right.
When did Jeff come into the picture there?
So Jeff kind of worked alongside us kind of for a while. I don't know what dates when he came on board, but he started with us full time pretty quickly after we decided to make Sell It Out pretty official. So,
and what was the vision? What was he going to do for you?
So Jeff's very much a relationship person. So he was really good at maintaining relationships and just trying to be the sales and marketing guy is what he's kind of hired for.
And that's what that's not your wheelhouse. Fair.
Yeah. I'm a technical guy. So
okay.
Was that Paul's wheelhouse? Paul was more of a motivator and a manager type than a sales guy.
Even. Okay. So he was a team leader kind of is what you're describing, right? So he was managing the team.
Yeah, so we brought on a couple. We started out with two other developers who, were pretty junior developers, and he was basically trying to get them up to speed, trying to get them familiar with our code base, struggling with that because nobody really understood my code, but trying to get them to launch and run other stuff, and that's where I think, they sort of started with this initial version of Scope that I talked about, and launching some of that. We wrote some really 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 early online arbitrage stuff. Before online arbitrage was even a term, some stuff with that.
And that was all coming out of the lab experiment for inventory management again, right? It would trickle off of that.
Yeah, we actually wrote a scraper for a toy store for a long time where we would actually automatically submit orders and automatically we'd actually list stuff on Amazon as merchant fulfilled, and we would, once it's sold, we'd go buy it and arbitrage it and drop ship it to the customer. We had like some pretty sophisticated stuff along this just about the time that the term online arbitrage was starting to get coined. We had some pretty cool stuff, but we were not really serious about it because our focus was on kind of the other software. So,
and at this point, partnerships working good? All the relationships you have are working well?
Yeah, I think everybody's pretty happy. Things are humming along. Yeah, I think everything's going pretty well.
Okay. What changed?
Oh, I don't know. It's still going pretty well, but I think we along the lines, we've started to hire up more people. I mean, this is a few years ago.
Well, did you become a big business? I mean, I guess I'm asking, back then it was you were writing all the code pretty much or leading the code, right? You're deeply involved in that. It sounds like Paul's involved in leading other people. Jeff's now out doing marketing. You're building it together, and it's growing, right? And at some point, you can start to lose touch and lose, I don't want to call it focus because I don't think that's fair. You just start to lose the connection. Maybe that's the right word I want to use. Did you feel like that at some point?
Yeah, I think there's been a couple of points where, early on, Paul or I are answering all the customer service emails, like we're interacting with people all day. And then at some point you bring in somebody to handle some of that because you're getting 30 customer service emails a day. You can't do that and run the business and write new code. So we brought in people to help do that. And I think there's been a couple points in there where maybe we felt a little less connected to our customers.
Yeah.
It's usually pretty easy for us. Like one of the reasons that we kind of value trade shows so much is that we go to trade shows a lot, not necessarily to sell our products or to exhibit or any of that kind of stuff, but it's more just to talk to people.
Okay. So you recognize that you got to stay in touch. Okay.
Yeah. We've always been really in really close contact in that way, as far as like getting to know some sellers. The trade shows have always been a great opportunity for us to get to talk to people one-on-one and really understand in more depth what somebody's trying to accomplish.
Okay. And so at this point now, all of a sudden, Feedback Genius is cranking along. What was the next vision? I mean, where was the next thing that you realized that there's a model and that we can bring to market? What's the next product?
So we had Scope was kind of going, but not really catching on. We had some big ideas.
Why wasn't it catching on?
It wasn't a very good product, I guess, for one thing. It was kind of buggy.
Ooh, that hurts to admit, doesn't it? Well, no, I'm serious. I mean, did you program it?
Yeah, I gave some like technical infrastructure architecture type advice.
Okay.
And then would dig in when stuff worked, but it was one of those where the data was starting to be kind of our Scope product has always been a kind of a big data thing, trying to do a lot of stuff. And we didn't have very good tools for it. It was kind of slow. Sometimes it'd work, sometimes it wouldn't. It would break sometimes. So that product, we never really, the initial version of Scope, we never really pushed. Again, this is 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that was tough. We actually wrote a thing a long time ago called another one of my sort of weekend projects was a tool called SearchRank, which was a tool that essentially you put in an ASIN and all the keywords you want to watch, and it would tell you what you rank for in organic search results for all those kind of things. So that's been one that's been out there for a while. Actually, we still run it and support it a little bit, and people still sign up for it, strangely, even though we never talk about it. I haven't talked about it for years, but people still find it somehow. So that's been one of those that kind of hung out there. It's been largely superseded by Scope, so that's why we don't really talk about it. Scope does everything that it does.
Okay. And so what was next?
So, Feedback Genius going well, Scope not really catching on. The next idea that we have is this amazing product called SnagShout.
Mm-hmm.
This is really more of Paul's brainchild than mine, but what we found was like people really needed to get product reviews. So they were using Feedback Genius to try and get product reviews, but it's really hard to send an email to a customer who hasn't bought something yet. So Feedback Genius worked really well for soliciting product reviews from customers that were already buying from you, but it didn't help you actually find new people to buy stuff from you. And that's where SnagShout really came into the picture. So private labeling was starting to become a big trend on Amazon. And so because of the flexibility that Feedback Genius offered, it was probably the biggest, you know, email automation tool for new private labelers. But they all had this problem as they needed to get product reviews. And that's where SnagShout really started with. Was how do I find customers to buy my brand new product that has no history?
Right, and that's a huge issue, still a big issue, right?
Still is an issue today. Yeah,
yeah. And so Paul had that figured that would be a direction, and so that was still came under the Seller Labs focus at that point.
Yeah, so we had the idea to start this. Obviously, we figured out how to do the coupon code thing, and people were very likely to buy a product at a steep discount. And then the social contract to leave a review for it. This was, when this was all kosher and according to Amazon, it was totally within the rules. They've since changed that. But this was probably early 2014, 15 maybe. I can't remember.
Okay.
Yeah, probably 2015. So we launched SnagShout, and that was the premise of it. You could, offer a steep discount on a product in exchange for a product review. And, our sellers just gobbled it right up. They solved a huge need that they had as far as trying to launch a new product and get reviews and traction on it.
And that was still within Amazon's terms of service at that point?
Yeah, at that point it was very, all the rules suggested that was the way it was and there was nothing going to change about that. So
Right. And they've evolved. I mean, I think it's, somebody who comes in now, oh my God, that's against the terms of service. Well, they weren't the term. Back when you started selling, there were no terms of service, right? I mean, let's face it. Back when we all started way back, there were nothing, it just evolved over time. And as things arise, right, they add a new rule just about every day. And so I think that's fair. And I think people have to get that perspective to understand that this stuff just doesn't happen overnight. You guys were developing this for a long time. And then now a change comes afoot. And then, the model you were using has to change along with it. How difficult is it when something like that happens? I mean, does that send you into turn, or do you guys get a little bit of an early nod to know, hey, you might have a problem here?
Well, we started feeling it was starting to be an issue, especially when the things that really led up, specifically in this case, like there was some news articles. It was getting, fairly wide mentioned in the press about the Amazon reviews were getting untrustworthy, mm-hmm. I guess would be the easiest way to say that, because there was people trying to game the system and push for reviews. So we started to read some of those articles and started to sort of see what was happening with that. We were actually in the middle of developing what SnagShout became after they changed the rules on it. We were pretty well in the middle of changing over towards that or developing a second sort of site that was more along the coupon and the discount thing.
Okay.
Without the reviews. But then I think Amazon kind of was pushed into that rather quickly because the holiday season was coming up and they just needed to make a change to help ensure confidence in the buyers. So
do you take that personally? I mean, here's somebody who, you guys put a lot of effort in it. I understand it was Paul's thing, but you had some ownership of it too. And you guys did it, and you thought you were doing it right. You weren't intending for somebody to be able to game the system. You were saying, hey, it is a quid pro quo, but you know, they could also leave just as negative comment just the same way, right? Do you take that personally when they all of a sudden, I mean, you get thrown in that group that basically you're helping, sure, you know, the bad guys?
Yeah, so I'll say, and one thing I'll say about Snagshot is we went to extreme measures to make sure that the reviews are honest. I think we did a lot of things that I wish other people would have done.
Oh. Do you think that would have changed the outcome, maybe?
I think if everybody would have operated the same way that Snagshot was, that would still be a thing. Unfortunately, a lot of people were doing things that would, you know, promote leaving only 5-star reviews. They kick off reviewers that didn't leave 5 stars. They do a lot of these things that were obviously, you know, not within the intent of what Amazon was trying to do, not within the intent of the review guidelines. And I think Snagshot, we spent a lot of effort, a lot of engineering, a lot of training our users to leave honest reviews. And I think if everybody operated the same way, that might still be a perfectly valid method for doing that. Unfortunately, there's competitors out there, other systems, Facebook groups, things that weren't even systems, would exploit that and, you know, would kick people off if they didn't leave 5-star reviews. They do things like this that definitely incentivized people inappropriately and that kind of stuff. So
all right. That's just Amazon, human nature, right? I mean, it's just the way it is. There's always going to be somebody who's going to skate right in the, not even in the gray. They'll go right to that bad area, and that's what they're going to do.
Yeah, so you asked if it was kind of a personal. Yeah, it was kind of personal because we felt like we were doing things the right way. And we felt like we were the kind of the best actors in the space, or at least one of the best actors in the space. But I definitely see it from Amazon's perspective too. Is like, if we don't have means to control this, so let's just turn it all off. They're not really going to differentiate who's the good people, who's the bad people. Just turn it all down.
And that's fair.
See the reason for it.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, let's face it. Amazon makes money when you sell stuff, right? They're not stupid. They want you to sell stuff, but they also have to protect on the other side because they got to look. This is a long game, right? And that's reasonable.
Yeah. I would have loved for Amazon to come to us and say, hey, we think you're one of the best ones. We're going to make you one of our gold star partners and find the 3 or 4 people who were the approved vendors. But that's just not the way they chose to do it.
They did
do that on some things, but on the marketplace side, they don't really go that route. So.
Oh, interesting. I mean, if you had a chance to talk to that executive team, that would be one of the things you would say is, hey, you know, create some standards and make sure that the people meet those standards. And then, you know, that way they could, you know, take advantage of that, right? I mean, that kind of makes sense.
But Amazon thought is like, we've got this Vine thing. We're just going to kind of make that available for sellers and transform what we have. So,
yeah, I think about, you know, a lot of that stuff. You know, when they all of a sudden pop out this review system that they have now, right? This didn't just happen last week, right? I mean, how long does something like that, because you've got experience in this world, how long does something like that take from start to finish?
For Amazon to do, I think it probably takes them about a year, I would guess.
Okay. So the stuff we're seeing now has been in development for a year. And so all these little personal nods like, hey, we're blocking this, or we're changing this, or whatever, they're probably all parts of a master plan to put out this, whatever this new thing is, right? I mean, that's reasonable.
Yeah, I mean, there's cases where they have some urgency and push stuff faster, but I think for the most part, their product people are planning and surveying and asking customers today for stuff they're going to start writing specs on next quarter, and then they're going to spend a quarter kind of planning it out in great detail, and then the following quarter or two they're going to actually start implementing.
So how does a company like yours read the tea leaf and try to stay ahead of that, right? I mean, that's got to really, because you have no control, and so ultimately they have control of your future in some ways, right? I mean, that's reasonable.
Yeah, Amazon drops a lot of hints.
Oh, okay.
So when you're in the middle of the industry, like when they send out a survey to sellers, just asking this, this, and this, like you kind of like, we've actually done the same thing. Like we're really curious. But Amazon did a thing about, I don't know what it was, at the beginning of the year, they did a survey about advertising on Amazon. Would you rather have this feature or that feature? And so, you know, in the back of our minds, we're figuring like Amazon's making plans for what they're going to develop 3 to 6 months from now.
It's probably video.
Yeah, we'd really like to know what they're developing. So we actually kind of sent basically the same survey to our customers and asked them the same things.
And then do you start developing?
Kind of know what Amazon can do.
I mean, do you start looks like they're going to come out with something a year from now. We need to start, you know, getting in that mode?
Yeah, I mean, I think we can operate. We can do stuff quite a bit quicker than Amazon can on the time scale. So that's where our advertising platform has sort of come out of that. As we saw, that was the thing back in October, and I don't know if you pay attention to Amazon advertising, but it's a pretty hot topic right now, and we're right in the middle of it. So
yeah, you're knee deep in the video side, especially, right? You host it and all that kind of jazz. So Quantify and Ignite, where do they come from? Do they also come from the lab?
Yeah, essentially. So this just, again, comes back to talking to customers. So with Quantify, what we noticed is one of the biggest needs the customer have is, you know, a customer will come and say, I've got 1,000 SKUs. Like, which ones are the ones that I should be focusing on? Which one? Which products do I have? Should I be advertising? Which products should I go in and change my listings on? And when you've got 1,000 SKUs, and we don't know your business very well, it's really hard for us to come in and say, this particular product's performing well, you should advertise it and get more page views on it. And this particular product, it has a great conversion rate, it has a great conversion rate, but you've got way too much stock, so you need to discount or change your price on it. Like the reason we developed Quantify was to solve those kind of problems, is to give us kind of a quick, actionable way to look at my inventory and figure out, you know, what are the products I should be promoting? What are the ones where I've got a team that's rewriting content and descriptions? Like, what's my poorest converting products so that I need to actually modify my content on those?
So it really just, it's like that silent partner that kind of says, okay, let me do the analysis for you. Here you go. Boom. Focus.
Kind of like the consultant that you go pay a bunch of money to, and they dig through your stuff and put it all back and then analyze some spreadsheets. And then they'd come up and say, you know, this is your action items for the next month. Go work on these 10 things. And then we're going to come back and talk next month.
How long has Quantify been out?
Quantify has been out since about February.
Okay.
So only about, 3 or 4 months.
So looking at the people, and maybe this is just too early, maybe this is a stupid question, but looking at the people that signed up early, have you been able to look at what they've been able to focus on, and has it evolved? I mean, logically, it would seem like it would evolve over time, right? Because what they focused on in February, assuming they put the effort in to focus and fix those things, March it would change, and then April, May, June. I mean, I would love to know, you know, what your experience has been.
Yeah, so I'm not very close to the Quantify team. I can speak really closely to the Ignite team, but I can tell you our process internally is basically the same. As like,
oh, okay.
Release stuff to users, listen to users and see what they like, see what they don't like, and then start to make changes on it. So like one of the biggest things that people told us about Quantify was like they want their data to be super accurate. They want it to be – actually one of the very first things that we learned was – we were using one of the sources of data we were getting for Quantify was delayed quite a bit, so it wouldn't give you real-time data.
Which is a problem.
People wanted to log in and see, like, how's today going? I don't care how 2 days ago was. I want to see how it is today. And so that was one of the first feature requests we got from Quantify was, like, I want to see how today's doing. And so the team would spend, you know, I don't know what boiled down to, a week or a month, depending on the feature and the complexity.
It would have been a weekend for you. But anyway, let's go ahead. They spend a week or a month. Go ahead.
Yeah, so that's what we spend the time working on. And then while we're developing that, we're still talking to customers. So we have a product manager who's in charge of talking to customers. And his job is really to be, like, getting stuff lined up for the programmers to work on when they finish their next round of things. So to the point where the development team's working on real-time data, and then our product manager, who's Ty in this case, is looking on, like, what do they want after that? Oh, they want better dashboards.
Okay.
And so he's trying to flesh out what those things are.
I'm interested to see, you know, over time, you know, to hear from those first customers what results they've had over time to see, you know, has it, you know, because it sounds like it, you know, it points you in a direction. Okay, you fix that. Okay, next point. I wonder what happens, you know, over time. Eventually, you know, you're working on, you know, in your example of 1,000 SKUs, they probably got to fix, you know, probably 750, all right, or 800 probably, right?
Sure.
And then, you know, does it get to 600? And then eventually, you know, I guess as you fix those problems, it probably finds new problems, right? Because, you know, you're working your way out, I guess is the way I would say it, right? Not working in, because you've started at the center and you kind of work your way out. Very interesting. All right, so speak about Ignite.
Yeah, so Ignite's one that's so I've been personally involved with Ignite, so I'm super excited about it. But we got access to the sponsored product API about in October last year. Identified advertising as like a big trend that's going to be around for a while, and so we started developing on it and released our initial tool in about January. Got some initial people talking about that, and then we more formally launched that in March with a bigger launch. And we've just been continuing to work through that same process with Ignite. So,
well, you said you got access to it. What's the effort that it takes? I mean, did they just say, oh, you know, hey, Steve, you want access to it? Sure, right? Or do you have to have proven history with them?
So this is just going back to like Amazon. I think so the way Amazon works in some of these cases is they're looking for potential users of the products.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was the team at Amazon had looked at us and they had identified us as somebody that had relationships with a whole lot of sellers.
Because
we have, obviously when a seller signs up to use us, they have to authorize us on their account. And so they identified Seller Lab. Well, you've got thousands of users that we'd like to help them advertise on sponsored products. So how can we get you access to this tool or this new API so that you can get a tool for your users to start using this new feature?
This is their funnel. I'm using you to help their funnel. Oh, that's interesting. I like that. I makes sense though, right? Makes perfect sense. What a great way to communicate with those sellers because you will have a relationship with them.
Yeah, so they figure the seller's already using our software, and if we can build sponsored products into our software, it'll help Amazon sell more sponsored products, which is, you know, we basically get the sales guy or the sponsored products team is the one who reaches out for that. But yeah, that's sort of how that evolved is we got access to the API. We started looking at it and deciding that was something we wanted to focus some effort on, and all of our other teams were busy, so I was like, this is really important. I'm going to do it myself. And so I got pretty much back into the writing code phase. And
did you feel it? I mean, was that exhilarating for you again? Were you back to putting a barcode on the shelf and then actually having somebody pull? I mean, is that what it felt like?
Yeah, I mean, it's not quite the same as a physical thing, like the barcode scanners and labels on books, but it is still satisfying to be able to see. Like,
were you giddy? Come on, fess up, Brandon. Yeah. Were you giddy a little bit? Just a little bit?
Yeah, it's pretty exciting when you go discover those things. Like we suggested, we made a change to this campaign where one of our early textbook examples was a seller who was selling a product, and his auto-targeted campaign was really bad. And we suggested better keywords for him to do. And he went from selling like one every few days to selling like 10 a day of this product. So,
ooh, yeah, that's rewarding, that's right there. Yeah, because it's rewarding. Again, you know, you did something, you thought, well, you saw something, you did it, it works, they got results, they thank you. I mean, it's that. Maybe it's a little delayed gratification, but it's back to that same thing. All right, I want to change direction because this has all been really positive. Everything's been great. But, you know, and you know, let's see how much you want to talk about. You've had a couple big challenges, one personally. Well, I guess they're both personal. I mean, you know, I don't know how much you want to talk about it, but I think both of them are personal in some ways. How do you want to start?
I don't know, talking about problems or
business struggles? Problems and personal problems, right? I mean, you've got some family situations. I don't know if you want to talk about that or not. I mean, to me, that's real. Sure. And the fact that you were able to, you know, and again, I mean, I think I alluded to this in the beginning. I got to see Brandon with this team in a very social, open place. It happened to be Brandon's birthday. And it's a very emotional day for me to watch, and I'm not a guy who's never met Brandon before a day in my life. I know Jeff really well, and I met some of the team earlier, but to see them and you and your wife, it was emotional. I mean, that was a very emotional for me to see, and I think to me, because I mean that was my little look from the side. Was it emotional for you?
I don't know. It was a pretty fun day. So I thought it was emotional from it. It was a long day of a lot of talking, exciting things going on. So I was pretty hyped about it and very excited. I think by the end of the day, I was getting fairly tired, but
okay.
It was a good day. So
okay.
But I
Well,
so I think what. Yeah, yeah, go ahead.
Well, I know it's awkward. I'm dancing around it. I'm trying to be as politically correct as I can because I just don't know how to talk about it.
Well, that's fine. I'll do it for you. How's that?
How about that? Yeah, please.
About 6 years ago, my wife was diagnosed with brain cancer or a brain tumor, I guess, technically. She was pregnant with our fourth child at the time. And so I was, I think at the time I was in the shower one day, came out, and she had a seizure, which completely out of context, completely blow our mind. We had no idea we didn't even know if it was a seizure or what the heck it was. So went to the hospital. She'd recovered from it and was standing up and fine. But we took her to the hospital. You go to the hospital, they say, well, that sounds really weird. Maybe you were just overheated or something. And so they take her and go to a CT scan and they say, well, there's something showing up on your brain CT scan. We want to take a closer look at it. It looks like you had a stroke. And my wife's, you know, not stroke would be kind of inappropriate. She's not very old. So have a stroke at her age and for somebody that's in pretty good health seemed weird. So that was the instruction we got. And they said, we're going to go take an MRI of it. It's a higher resolution thing. And so they go do that. And then they come back, whatever it is, 20 minutes later or something. And they say, well, actually, it's not good news. It's not a stroke. Your wife actually has a brain tumor.
Oh, that's good news.
So,
ouch.
It's not the one bad news. And it was really kind of surreal because we didn't really know what to expect of that.
This is your fourth child, so this means you have a baby at home.
So we had three kids at the time. She's pregnant with number four.
We're pregnant with number four. Okay, and so you've got a young family, and so you know the possibility. And this was 6 years ago. Okay, all right, go ahead.
So the instruction is the neurologist comes in and says, it looks like you have a brain tumor. Here's an MRI of it. You can sort of see it on the thing here. Here's some medicine. Come talk to us next Wednesday and don't drive in the meantime. That was about the extent of it. not a lot of explanation about what was going on. Obviously, we're kind of traumatized by, brain tumor sounds pretty serious. It is. But the direction we got was essentially like, here, take this medicine in the meantime, and we'll talk about it next week when you come in. And by the way, don't drive anywhere on your own.
Okay.
That was really weird. So
you're working all this time, right? This is when, it's 2011, thereabouts, and you're developing, how do you handle that with your business? I mean, because let's face it, there are people out there that have businesses and life is going to happen to them too. How do you, and you've got kids at home, I mean, how do you get through that and work through that?
There's definitely some emotion that goes into that when you hear news like that, and I'm sure plenty of people have had, friends and family that have been diagnosed with cancer of some shape or some kind of form. It's unfortunately fairly prevalent.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's something that you just put one foot in front of the other and keep on going. Fortunately, it hasn't changed our life a lot. So we've been very fortunate to have very good doctors, very on top of the medication. She's done chemotherapy numerous times and radiation and chemotherapy and all that kind of stuff. You talk to her, you wouldn't even know that there was anything wrong with her.
Yeah, perfectly normal. But 6 years later, is she, is she in remission or what's happening now?
I mean, she still takes chemo in fact, she's got a round of chemo. I think she's doing tomorrow. So she takes it every 3 weeks right now. So it's just become kind of a normal part of our lives. So the main thing that's different about our lives because of it is she can't drive.
Okay.
And so logistically, it's tough to have we have to have a helper or a nanny to help get her around and do stuff. She doesn't like to be left alone with the kids because of this risk of a seizure. So that sort of affected us on a day-to-day basis to have somebody to help her out while I'm at work. But for the most part, it's just something we live with now. So,
I mean, what's the long-term prognosis?
It's not an operable type of tumor at the moment because it's the same type of tissue as regular brain tissue.
Okay.
So it's not something they can go and take a scalpel to and remove it. But it's just to monitor it and pay attention to it and use the chemo and drugs and stuff when something happens. So,
well, how does this affect your day-to-day decisions? I mean, is this when you think about where you're going, what your dreams are, where you want to go? Does this play into it? I mean, it sounds stupid. I know that's a stupid question. I guess I'm trying to say I'm thinking about when you're looking out, you would have a different. You must have a different perspective than me. I mean, duh, right? I mean, let's face it. You're going through something I'm not, so therefore you've got to take a different approach. I guess that's what I'm trying to say, and I'm not saying it in the most delicate way. But, I mean, how do you think into the future, when you're planning and stuff?
It changes some expectations, I think. So, I mean, she doesn't like to travel very much because she doesn't want to be on a plane for 12 hours in case of some medical problems or something like that. So it affects maybe some of the things we'd like to do when we grow up or when we get older. But I think we figure out how to work around that and just how to figure out instead of flying somewhere, we're going to have to go on a cruise. So
yeah, but you make it makes your relationship that much stronger, right? Communication has to be paramount in your world.
Yeah. I mean, I think you figure out ways around it. So that's one of the things. Communication, I think all this stuff. I mean, we've got four kids now too, so that keeps us pretty busy with plenty of things. So.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Okay, well, you handled it much better than I did. I apologize for being a little indelicate there, but I just think that where that plays into it, where other people are going to have, life is going to happen to you, right? I mean, that's really the premise of that, of this part of my segment here, is that life is going to happen to you, how you manage that, how you deal with it. And it sounds like to me, you dealt with it just in a normal course. I guess it's that computer brain again. You're going back to, hey, break it down, do this, do this, do that, routine. Here's the results, right? That's kind of.
I don't claim to have figured it out or anything, but I think, you know, we've been living with it for 6 years now, and it's just kind of a day to day. We don't think of it as different, I guess, at any point in time. So,
okay.
Certainly, I know other people that have been diagnosed with cancer have very different expectations and experiences. So I'm not saying it's a way for everybody to handle it. I'm just saying it's kind of has worked for us given our situation. It definitely does impact what you think about a little bit and certain things like that, especially in the day to day, like I mentioned. But you know, overall, it's just life's going to happen. So you just do whatever you can. Do what you can today.
I like the life is going to happen. Ooh. Okay, so you and Paul are not partners anymore, correct?
Yeah, so this is recent news, I guess, as of about a month ago. So Snagshout has always been kind of a different thing. I think as I described it in your show, even here, it's always been kind of Paul's idea, mm-hmm. Paul's brainchild. What we found is like Snagshout is just a very different product. It has a B2B component, which we were familiar with how to handle B2B, but it also has a very strong B2C component where you have to interact with customers and make things for the customers. Mm-hmm. And so what we discovered is like when we're trying to figure out how to prioritize things for Seller Labs, Snagshout never got the love that it really needed. It never got the attention that it needed because we didn't really know. It was different for one thing. It wasn't the B2B side 100% like we were used to. And so it was hard for us to figure out how to spend money on marketing or building a better consumer experience.
Did that create... I don't want to call it conflict. Did it start to show like some emotions or feelings there? I mean, was there, you know, was Paul starting to feel a little bit of pressure about that, saying, hey, wait a second, you know, this is something I believe in strongly and fair. I mean, let's face it, it was his idea.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're passionate about, like you said, about Ignite because you're knee deep in it, right? You live and breathe it. And if Paul was breathing that, I mean, that's not an unfair thing. But you also have to look at this as a business, right? And this has to make a profit.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think, I mean, we were both intimately involved. This is both our thing. It was going to be bound to be a little bit emotional. But I think we've gotten through it pretty easily. I think we understand like it's for both in both of our best interests because now, you know, Snagshot can go and do what it needs to do, which is all about like trying to get consumers on board and using it, still providing value to the sellers that are using it. But it really has the resources and it's really just kind of separation of priorities. Its priorities are not entangled with those of Seller Labs now.
Seller Labs might have been holding it back in essence. I mean, to be fair.
Yeah, I think, I mean, that's what it boils down to is like, because it was tied to Seller Labs for so long, and actually from day one, maybe not day one, but a few months into it, we were deciding like, we understood the metrics of what it takes to run a successful SaaS business. Snagshot was different in every respect from that kind of stuff. We understood how to communicate with our sellers and drive value and, you know, go to trade shows. Like we could do that on the B2B side, but we didn't know how to do it on the B2C side. And so it always was kind of an oddball. And so just giving it like I said, from day one, it was always like, do we make this a separate business or is it really part of Snagshout? And it just got to be kind of like different enough eventually, especially after Amazon changed those rules on us. Like it just became pretty evident that we needed to make a separation there. It needed to have its own clear priorities, its own team around it so that both companies could do what they were really needed to do in order to grow and to strive to the best.
But you guys were together for a long time. I mean, you know, I liken it to a marriage, right? I mean, a partnership can be a marriage, has a lot of the same qualities. How does that split go? How does that conversation go? Because it seems amicable. I mean, you know, it sounds like one of those divorces that are, you know, everybody's on board and everybody agrees. They just knew it was coming and it just, how does that happen? Because that's not easy.
I don't know. I think a lot of this comes back to like, it was kind of it was kind of always Paul's thing to begin with, so okay. It wasn't really that big a change when we decided to separate it out. Like, he knew the programmers, the staff that was on it, was it was obvious who was going to go and go on to the with to run Snag Shout.
And you were okay with that. I mean, you were mature enough to say, you know, this really is his, and you know what, I'm willing to give up my piece of it because, quite frankly, he's still a friend, and so therefore, you know, he's earned it. I mean, that's cool. I don't know many people that would be that way, Brandon. I'll be honest with you.
Yeah, I mean, I think ultimately I would have liked to have a ownership in Snag Shout at some point. We decided not to go that way just for clarity and everything, but you know, we could have gone either way on that, I guess.
Well, that's a mature business team that could see that and work their way through it. Because again, it's like one of those amicable divorces where it's just like, okay, yep, this was business and we separated that. Looking back, would you do it different?
Honestly, I think maybe doing it a little bit earlier might have been made more sense. I think because of the conflicting priorities and stuff, like Snag Shout may have done better if we would have done this a year ago or something.
Okay. I mean, that's fair. I mean,
it's always, you know, just thinking in theories at this point, who knows what would have happened, but, yeah, I don't know. Maybe doing it sooner would have been better off. But I think it's still a pretty new thing. So who knows?
Right. But, again, the best part is that you're still friends. I mean, that's usually most partnerships when they kind of dissolve usually don't work that way. And so I admire that about you. So what do you think is next for Seller Labs? You know, you're sitting here coming up with ideas, trying to read the tea leaves. Like you said, Amazon leaves clues, right? Or like success, right? You see them leaving clues. You kind of looking out a year in advance. Where do you see Seller Labs going next?
So the thing we're focused on at the moment is building our products. Obviously, making a better product pretty much always wins. In this
period.
Case. So
yeah, period. Yeah,
if you don't have a superior product, like there's somebody else will build something that's better. So it's all about like putting more effort, more doubling down, putting more effort in design and just building a better product all around. One of the reasons that we see might be a slight change from where we're going is like we're seeing a lot of people who are not traditional like Amazon only sellers are entering the space. Mm-hmm. So you see a lot of people that have vendor accounts that are starting to open 3P accounts because there's a lot of benefits on the 3P side.
An example there. So do you have a company that you can give an example with?
Oh, I try to make up a company. I don't know.
Well, I mean, would it be like I'm looking at my Columbia? Well, that's a bad example. How about I'm looking at my highlighters? I don't know who makes highlighters. Let's see who it is. Avery, I think it says.
So Avery might be selling to Amazon as a 1P seller right now.
Okay.
Amazon's buying their product by the pallet load, probably. Amazon has a buyer in their team on the Amazon first party side, or they call it the Amazon vendor side. And the highlighter company doesn't really know anything about selling to consumers. They don't know anything about sales tax. They just want to manufacture their highlighters and ship them off and have a retailer sell them. And that's a very traditional relationship. And so there's a lot of stuff for sale on Amazon, about 50%-ish, 45% maybe of the stuff sold on Amazon is sold with this relationship.
And I want to pause you there a second. And what's changing, right? The retailers that they were selling to are closing their doors. Fair?
I mean,
there's 5,000 vendor, 5,000 locations, 5,000 retail locations have been announced closed already at the beginning of June so far this year. They projected 8,000, but it's going to be more than 10,000, they're saying. So, Avery might not be the perfect example, but they were selling to these other places, right? Now they got to find a place to sell to. That's got to play into it.
Yeah, if you're Avery and you were selling, I don't know,
to Kmart.
If you were selling $1 million of highlighters to Kmart and Kmart's going out of business, you got to expect that like that $1 million you made last year is not going to be coming this year, right?
Right.
And where do they see that picking up at? Obviously, it's coming through Amazon instead. So,
okay.
What we see happening, and so a lot of vendors are just perfectly happy still selling their stuff to Amazon and letting Amazon do all the marketing and all the sales and everything around it. They still, that vendor relationship still works. But what we're finding is that some of those more savvy, more people who really want to get into Amazon are starting to open up Amazon third-party accounts, which is where Seller Labs really bread and butter has been at, because the third-party relationship gives them sort of a closer touch to the consumer. They get so the manufacturer in this case would own the product all the way up until it's delivered to the consumer. They have to provide customer service for it. They have to figure out how to do all the sales tax remittance and all that kind of stuff. There's a lot of stuff that goes into that. But they also get a little bit better experience and more marketing tools and some other things like that in that Amazon relationship.
Wait, they get to control that right up to the end. It's kind of like what you said about the reason you guys do so well is you take the feedback from your customers and then fine tune things, right? They get the same experience, right? They get to find Steve actually used his highlighter, left feedback. They get to see it not filtered through a third party, right? Because let's face it, they're going to get filtered. Well, you know, those are negative comments, but really here's what they meant. You know, this, they get real. That's good and bad.
That's one aspect of it is just the direct, like literally they are the ones, they're the party selling it to the consumer. And sometimes they go through a consultancy or an agency or somebody else where they're a step removed. But the other side of it too is like, what happens if I'm selling six packs of highlighters on to say Office Depot or Kmart or something? Traditionally, what they've done is they've just sold the same six packs to Amazon, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, because of the economics around shipping and all this other stuff, maybe a six pack isn't the right case quantity to sell on Amazon. Maybe you need to sell a 12 pack instead. Like the Amazon vendor, the Amazon buyer is not necessarily going to give your highlighter company that feedback. All they're going to notice is like they're not selling very many six packs of highlighters.
So you're saying that because the highlighter company is now a third party, nobody's going to be talking to them like they were if they were a vendor.
Yeah, I mean they have to figure this out on their own.
So there's a gap, is what you've identified. So, yeah.
Yeah. What it boils down to is on the if you have a 1P relationship with Amazon, you have a buyer on the Amazon side that's buying from you and buying from 1,000 other companies,
mm-hmm.
and they don't really care that much about your highlighter company because they got 999 other companies they're buying from as well. So they're not really going to put that much effort into it. Certainly when they're in contract negotiations and when they say they're going to take 1% of your sales and market and do stuff on your behalf, they'll tell you how aggressive they are about that. But when it boils down to it, like they're not that interested in your highlighter company. So if you really want to go the extra mile and really like make your Amazon presence, really double down on that, really put effort into it, like you take it, you own the relationship, you become a 3P seller. And then you have more control over your destiny. So you're not just relying on the Amazon buyer and the Amazon algorithms. Another really, really classic example of what happens is I might be selling highlighters to Amazon and Amazon's got it priced way, way too high and nobody's buying it. And because nobody's buying it, the Amazon algorithms don't say to order more of them.
Right.
And so if they don't order more of them, then they might buy one or two from you at a time. And that's just not economical. Where if you own the relationship, you own the pricing, you can say, look, the retail price on this is supposed to be $6.99 and not this $20 that Amazon retail has somehow figured out, whatever they got that price from. So you can really change the price to what it should be, and then you drive the sales.
You know, the big risk for them, though, is affecting the highlighter company while they get in this business is now they're basically competing against the people they sell to in the retail market, right? They're retailers that sell these products. That's a very thin line they have to walk, a fine line, right? I mean, that's really dangerous.
It is. It's one that people have been figuring out for, you know, 5 or 8 years, as some people have figured out how to do that. So it's not easy for the highlighter company to say, you know what, we're now going to sell direct to consumer on Amazon. But a lot of people have figured it out.
It's going to happen faster, right? It's not going to get slower. It's going to accelerate. It has to, because again, like you said, they were selling 1 million to Kmart. What do they do with that? They just can't. They can't shut down their manufacturing plant for that, right? They got to sell it somewhere.
Well, this is what I mean. A lot of third party sellers have been doing this for a long time. They've been going to their manufacturers and saying, you know, I should be the exclusive seller of this product on Amazon,
right?
Because when I'm the exclusive seller, then I have the motivation to actually make it better, to follow up on the reviews, to suggest a different case pack quantity. If I'm only one of 30 sellers, like I don't really care that much about it. I'm only selling 1% of them anyway. So if I'm the exclusive seller, then I understand Amazon better, then I'm going to do better. But if I'm not the exclusive seller, it doesn't really make sense for me to put the effort into it because everybody else benefits from my work.
So you see both the two main ways you see it. Either the 3P, either the vendor, the manufacturer is going to become the 3P, or they're going to use an agent, one person, one company, an independent kind of company that will be their representative, almost their agent.
Yeah, I see a lot of value in that. So the people that are doing 1P right now are wanting to, they're figuring out, like, we actually want to spend more money on Amazon because all these retail stores are going away. Amazon is driving a bigger chunk of their revenue. They're more dependent on Amazon. They want to have more control over that and understand it better rather than just leaving it in Amazon's hands and Amazon's algorithms to figure it out.
So you see a role for Seller Labs in that relationship somehow?
Yeah, so I think we've built the best tools there are for 3P sellers. So as more of these companies start to come on board, I think we'll see, you know, our traditional seller is not going to be exclusively 3P. Like, that's not even been exclusively 3P in the past, but I think we'll see a bigger portion of them that have these hybrid relationships where they're doing both 3P and 1P.
Have you started marketing towards that? I mean, have you started attending different trade shows that are, you know, where the traditional 1P sellers would be at to start marketing to them?
So we're starting to ramp up what that is a little bit. So that obviously we're starting to provide a few tools on the 1P side, specifically around advertising, because the tools there are really not very good right now. So I think that's kind of our gateway in. We're also developing what we call Seller Labs University, where we'll be able to have essentially a kind of a training course for these people that have that don't have a lot of like direct to consumer experience. They're traditionally manufacturers and they're not used to having this direct to consumer thing. So we're putting together a bunch of educational content for them to be able to say, like, this is how you sell on Amazon, and trying to walk like maybe a new employee or a channel manager through the Amazon marketplace. I think, you know, that's just the route of the tip of the iceberg on where we're going with some of this. So,
you know, we were sitting at the Prosper conference, and it was Andy Slamons, myself, and someone else. We're just sitting there on the table, and we met a young lady and a couple guys from a company, and they represented this massive manufacturer, and she's their e-commerce person. And she's having this exact discussion with them, saying, look, we've got thousands and thousands and thousands of products in our catalog. We need to take control of some of them. You know, and so she's fighting against these, you know, stereotypical white-haired old men and trying to get them to buy into it. But wait, I've been selling to Johnny's father and his grandfather and everybody else, and we can't hurt them. And so she's basically doing what you described, kind of narrowing it down, saying, all right, instead of having 40 sellers, we're going to drop it down to 4 main sellers or 3. And eventually, I think their goal being to 1, and eventually they would take that 1 or not. But I think that that's naturally, she was describing it, and it was their catalog. She's like, we have thousands and thousands and thousands of products. And it's like, huh, that is absolutely the direction that the world's going in.
Yeah, there's lots of ways to do that. I mean, a really common one is just to say, like, normally for our brick and mortar stores, again, go back to the six pack highlighter thing. We're going to keep selling you six packs of highlighters, but when we sell them on Amazon, we're going to be the exclusive seller of 12 packs of highlighters or whatever it is. So,
right, because an individual person buying it would only want 6, you know, in the store level, but yet at the higher level. Okay, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. So that's a very
easy way to do it. Yeah.
That's not taking away from your focus. That's just kind of complementing what you do, right? It kind of works, you coincide, because, you know, is it fair that the 3P seller that you're seeing is a much larger seller today than it was a couple of years ago?
Yeah, I mean, I shared this statistic back at our Resonate conference, but we did a survey of all of our sellers, like looking at how much their sales grew from 2015 to 2016. Mm-hmm. We found that our average seller grew by 250%.
To what level? What would be your average seller? What dollar amount would they be at?
So if you were selling $1 million in 2015, you did $2.5 million in 2016.
Okay, all right.
Anywhere from that $500,000 to maybe $5 million range is kind of our current core of customers.
That's your sweet spot right in there.
Yeah. So if you were doing $500,000 last year and you're doing $1.25 million or something this year, like internally, like your company is growing a lot.
It's exploding. Think about, I always tell this, you know, think about that little store down on Main Street selling candles. They don't do $500,000. You're kidding. If they do $100,000, it's a lot, right? And so when you're, and I usually say this, and I think this is fair, is that, you know, you can do $30,000 a month by yourself on Amazon, you know, with some effort, don't get me wrong, and I don't want to downplay it, but you can do that. Once you start getting to that $500,000, you do have to buy help. And so that's why people would be hiring your service, because they can't do it themselves. They can't reply to feedback and they can't do things. So they have to use these other services, right? And they have to start planning and figuring things out. Very, very cool. Well, I appreciate, you know, you talking about the two things. I mean, one, again, your family, and I wish you nothing but the best there. I mean, it's just got to be very difficult. I love the way, though, that you approach it. It's, hey, this is a part of, you know, it's your computer brain again. Hey, we break it down, we do steps, we get through it, and we move on. I love that. And then I also appreciate the fact, the way you handled the separation in your business. That's very mature, and most partnerships do not end that way, I'm here to tell you. That's a very cool thing that you remained friends throughout it. That also says something about your character. Brandon, if someone, I love the fact that you have channel managers or product managers, I guess that's what their titles are, right? Is that the best way, if somebody has specific, you know, ideas about, and I think Tyler would be a good example for Scope. He's out there pushing that, right? And saying, hey, give me feedback. What else do you want to see? Where do you want to go? Is that the best way if somebody has product enhancement ideas? Is that the place they should go? Or do you want them coming to you or to Jeff? Or what would you think?
Well, I mean, the first line of thing would just be to suggest it in a regular one of our support tickets. If you have a conversation with one of our support staff, that gets channeled up. And essentially, our support staff is kind of there handling most of the day-to-day interaction with customers. They're answering the phones, the emails, and the chats and all that kind of stuff. And so that's the easiest way is just to bring it forward there. If you have a really good example, one of the things that makes those kind of suggestions really useful mm-hmm. is if you've got a really concrete example of how something would be beneficial to you. If you have a vague idea of like, I wish the product would do this, we kind of get it. But if you have a really concrete example around it, it makes it even, you know, really.
Well, then you can calculate it, right? Then you can sit down and say, okay, yeah, we could see the benefit, and therefore we have how many users and blah, blah, blah. And you can see that there's a bit, because it ultimately is a business, right? You have to make a business case for it.
Yeah. Every day we have to decide, do we want to do feature A or feature B?
And right.
Sometimes those things are user-facing features. And we try to do features that provide immediate value to our customers as much as possible. But quite honestly, a lot of times, like, we have to worry about how performant these things are, how much it costs to perform this stuff. We've actually gone through a round of stuff over the last month that was like a lot of cost saving stuff, which didn't benefit our users at all necessarily, other than that our internally, we saved a lot of money.
Right. I mean, you can use that now to, you know, I mean, think about it, right? You got to make your dollars work. So you get to use that money to develop other things. I mean, that's reasonable. That's very healthy, by the way.
Yeah, so sometimes we do user-facing stuff. Sometimes we do internal stuff that's either making it easier to support, or making it cost less, maybe it's making it easier to maintain for, you know, sometimes we go through these little phases where we'll have a sprint or two where we're just working on tickets that makes it easier for our support department to log into an account and analyze something or whatever it is. So we're working on this stuff. We actually have full-time teams on each one of our products, and so we're working on all of them every day. Sometimes users don't see the net result of those, but we do. We have people doing that. Our product managers are essentially the guys who kind of help prioritize and figure out what the roadmap is.
And they're the ones communicating directly with the users, right?
Yeah. Well, our support staff kind of has the day-to-day communication, and then once something, like if one of our product managers says that this is a feature that we want to build, they're kind of responsible for saying, hey, I need to find some customers that have a really good use case for this. And then they call you up on the phone or do a screen share or a Skype, something like that. Maybe dig into your use case and figure out, like, what exactly you're trying to do. How can we make our application do what you want? And then the product manager kind of interprets that, understands it, and then passes that along to the product team who will work on actually coding it and making it work.
Yeah, I think a lot of that is invisible to the users. But, you know, I mean, you know, like you say, though, you have to develop it. They're all competing interests, and everybody wants resources, right? And so you've got to sit there every day and say, is it A or B? Because it's going to be one or the other, right? And I'm sure sometimes it's both, but generally it's one or the other. You got to make a decision where the biggest benefit for the user is. And I think because you're taking that approach, that's why you've had so much success. I mean, to be fair, you know, I'm blowing smoke at you. I mean, that seems reasonable to me. You're taking a customer first focus. I mean, I understand you're there to make money. But I mean, you're saying, wait a second, we want to do what our customers say? That makes sense.
Well, I think maybe that's hopefully come out in our whole interview here that we talked.
I think so. I think,
you know, our customers really drive our products. So we understand what they're doing pretty intimately. We figure out how to make something useful for them. And then hopefully they want to pay us money to do that.
I think I come back to, you know, again, that you were a bookseller. You lugged those books. You've bent over Gaylord boxes with your back hurting, right? So you can relate doing it in your garage and moving into bigger space and trying to find those efficiencies over time. And that's what you're trying to do for seller. To me, that's come through clear to me, and I would hope other people hear the same thing. All right, let me put you on the spot. So, best way to get in touch with you if somebody has a follow-up question before I ask my final question.
Sure, my email is just brandon@sellerlabs.com. It's the easiest way to do it. I check my email way too often.
Okay, so brandon@sellerlabs.com, and I'll put that link there. Okay, so the goal of the podcast is to help people move forward past stuck. So I'm going to put you on the spot and say, come on, Brandon, give us a tip or a trick that you think people can put into their business, regardless of the size, that they can help move their business forward today.
I knew you were going to ask me this, but I don't know if I've come up with any great answers for you.
Well, I don't know we need a great answer. I think most of the time the simplest answer seems to be the best answer.
Yeah. So I guess one of the premises that I come back to is like it's better to have tried something and failed than it is to like have wondered about it for a long time. So if you're curious about something, like what's the impact of trying a new piece of software? Like maybe you'll waste an hour or two, and maybe it won't be useful for you. But on the flip side, maybe it'll be really beneficial for you.
It's your whole business, dude. I mean, I'm sitting here thinking about you heard your friend, your wife's friend's comments, or you read them in a thing. You've created this multi-million dollar business in this lab, and all these little things keep coming out of it. That's your whole, I mean, the weekend coder, this is you.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to get more technical about it, and you go ask an MBA student, they'll talk to you about the risk to rewards and J curves and that kind of stuff. And if you want to dig into it academically, you can start to read about risk to reward ratios. And like, you want to take reasonable risks that have the greatest chance for reward.
Calculated.
Yeah.
So. Love it. All right. Man, I wish you nothing but I'm so excited to see what you guys are doing. It's, again, I love the customer first focus. To me, that's it. Period. Superior product. Do it with the best interest, and you're going to have the most success. I wish you nothing but success. Can't wait to see what you guys do next. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks so much. It's been great talking to you today.
How many of you could split off a company and still be friends with them? Man, I just love that. I love the way they handle that. In unnoticeable to us as the users, and yet, you know, they could still remain friends. That's a big deal. So I hope you like that. Very smart man, very smart company. Be clear, they are sponsors of my show. I wasn't pulling back my punches, though, as you heard. I'm uncomfortable talking about, you know, cancer and someone's wife anyway. So that part is delicate. But the rest, I don't pull any punches. But I respect them because, again, they're putting the customer first. How many people do that? They take feedback, they go back. So if you have issues, if you're not getting the results you need, don't put them in Facebook groups. Contact them directly. Get in there and get some help. And if you see a direction they should go in, get in those user groups and start using them. Man, I love that they are that approachable. ecommercemomentum.com, ecommercemomentum.com. Follow me on Instagram, ecommercemomentum. Follow me on Twitter, ecommercemomentum, ecommercemomentum.com. Take care.
Thanks for listening to the e-commerce Momentum Podcast. All the links mentioned today can be found at ecommercemomentum.com under this episode number. Please remember to subscribe and like us on iTunes.